Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope. And I am your host, Rory Hearn, and joined today, delighted to be joined by Chloe Timperley, author of a new book, Generation Rent. Chloe, thanks for joining us in Reboot Republic today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm really looking forward to this conversation. It's something that I've researched myself as well and written on, Generation Rent, and it's a major, major issue in Ireland. And I know there's a lot of people stuck in it, a lot of people interested in it. But just to start, I'm actually going to read the first two paragraphs of your preface, which I was really struck by. And you begin by saying, Generation Rent is ultimately the story of how the UK turned its youth into an asset class. Over the latter part of the 20th and early 21st centuries, housing went from being a basic good to a financial asset. As it did so, our homes went from being a store of wealth for occupiers to a store of wealth for landlords and speculators. This trend goes beyond the behavior of buy-to-let investors and begins in the popular imagination. Before we can restore justice and decency, we must change the cultural view of our homes as personal trophies, pension pots and money-making machines, rather than basic necessities for a normal life. There's so much in there in that. And maybe before I ask you, what do you mean in that? Maybe you could outline firstly, what is Generation Rent? Who are Generation Rent?
I would say with Generation Rent, because there's a whole multifaceted housing crisis going on, and there's so many different moving parts. I would say the Generation Rent part specifically is probably people who kind of have no business being in the private rented sector. You know, they're people who are working, they're wanting to put down roots, they've got some security, maybe they want to start a family, and yet they just cannot get off the renting treadmill. And these are people who 10, 20, 30 years ago would have had no, maybe not 10 years ago, but certainly sort of if they'd been born maybe a decade earlier, they probably would have just bought a home and it wouldn't have been this huge, mountain to climb to get onto the property ladder. Yeah. So that's how I would perhaps define that.
Okay. And is in terms of the idea of the, because I started the property ladder, you know, what, this is an idea that, you know, somehow you get your step on, you buy your first house, then you buy your second house. But really, the property ladder doesn't exist anymore, does it?
No. Well, this is one of the things that I found really interesting, actually, in my research, how the property ladder is just a completely broken concept. Because I've heard, you know, you hear maybe some older generations saying, like, oh, the problem with young people today is they don't want to get a fixer-upper basic starter home that's kind of falling to bits. And you know, they make do and mend and then they buy a bigger house and they upsize. The problem is they just want to go straight into like the three bedroom family home. And I think that's such an unfair, the reason that's such an unfair observation to make is that one, because homes take so long to save up for, by the time you've actually got your deposit together, you are at that stage where you need the family home. You know, the goalposts move. I think a one bed flat in the city centre is maybe a great starter flat, a starter home for if you're 21, 22. But as soon as you're getting into your early 30s, you're at a different life stage. And the second reason why it's an unfair observation is the fact that the rungs on this fictional property ladder are so far apart now. It's actually harder to jump from a starter home to a second home. People are actually getting more help from parents in terms of deposits. It's harder to make that leap. So really your first home, mentally, you've got to be prepared for the possibility that you're going to be in that home for maybe 10, 15 years. You're probably going to be stuck there. I think sort of broadening the definition of generation rent, it's actually, yes, there's a lot of people stuck renting, but when you buy your first home, the troubles don't end because it's so expensive. You've got an enormous 35. Sometimes I have a friend that had taken out a 40-year mortgage. And there's no real sense of escalation or moving up. It's just very, very tight and very financially burdensome.
And in the renting sector in the UK, you know, and England, and maybe you could explain it, like in Ireland here, there's major problems in the private rental sector of, you know, unaffordable rents, poor quality, you know, lack of tenure security. security. And this is a, you know, is a problem that the people who are left, you know, stuck renting, they're stuck renting in very difficult situations. Is it, what's it like over there?
I mean, I hear tell that it's actually a bit worse in the UK, because I think we have a very, very insecure tenure whereby, I mean, the pandemic things have been extended. We currently have a 6-month notice period minimum. But in prior to pandemic times, your landlord could give you 2 months notice and you don't have to have done anything wrong whatsoever. You can have been the model tenant, but you get 2 months notice and you have to leave. Which is one thing if you're kind of a young professional who's quite mobile and can sort of dust yourself off and move on. But if you're a family and you've got, you know, a local school and you've got your support network around, people's lives have really been upended by these, they're called Section 21 eviction notices, no fault evictions. The government has committed to scrapping them, but we've so far had no action on that. So yeah, it is a very, very insecure lifestyle, particularly, and the quality as well. Private rented sector homes in England, you know, according to the English Housing Survey, they're the worst quality housing of all tenures. People think of social housing as the worst type of housing. Mm. This kind of boogeyman kind of image of what it's like in their heads. But if you look at the data, the private rented sector has the worst quality housing.
And in the sense that the issues affecting Generation Rent are actually, like, they're not really visible for others, are they? That there's a real kind of, you know, I think an under appreciation of the extent of this, you know, what I call housing shock, which is this collapse of, you know, home ownership and the over-reliance and the huge increased reliance in the private rental sector and the long-term implications of it. That for those who aren't in Generation Rent, there seems to be a belittling of the situation, of their circumstances.
Yeah, and this is another thing where the external visuals don't match what's really going on, because I think previously everything else was more expensive. I looked at sort of inflation figures and how, for example, comparing what you would have spent on foreign travel or the latest gadgets in the 80s versus what you spend on those things today. And pretty much everything in our economy, I mean, if you think of the internet, it's been profoundly deflationary. Owning music, watching films, entertainments, even just like ordering stuff off, you know, off online, it's massively brought prices down in every single arena apart from housing, where prices have shot up. They've actually kind of doubled in real terms. You know, different sources say different things, but they have kind of just in relation to incomes, they've become way, way divorced from where they were. So what perhaps somebody from the older generation might see is somebody with an iPhone, somebody who's maybe got a Netflix subscription, or, you know, even furniture. Furniture, we now have cheap as anything flat pack furniture. And it can look from the outside as if you have this very pleasant life, and it's like, well, they're not struggling, that doesn't look like someone who's poor, why are they complaining about not being able to afford a housing deposit? And my point that I make is that even if you sacrifice all these things, even if you deny yourself all of these things, the amount of money you save is minuscule because the amount of money you need for a deposit is so much bigger, and it's, you know, it almost becomes, what is it actually worth? It is it worth depriving yourself of kind of mod cons when you're not really that much further ahead than your friends who've kind of given up, basically.
Yeah. And is there a kind of a social class dimension to this as well, and a migrant dimension, that those who are, you know, on even lower incomes are, you know, really struggling within the private rental sector and, you know, face this whole, you know, are really struggling? Do you see that, or did you come across that?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because when it comes to class, I think it's very deceptive because it starts off with all young people seeming to be in the same boat. You all graduate together. You're all on these like very low paid graduate scheme type jobs. Or maybe, yeah. I mean, if you're like me, I didn't even get into a graduate scheme job at first. I was working in a cafe. And it's very, yes, it's sort of a struggle, but it did seem to be quite a social leveler. There wasn't really a divide between how well my friends from wealthier backgrounds were doing versus how well, friends from poorer backgrounds and, you know, compared to myself and all that kind of stuff. We all seem to be on a par. But yeah. As we've got older, as we've got into our late 20s, the divides are starting to show. And I think a lot of young renters I've spoken to have seen this, is that you thought you were in it together, and then suddenly your friends kind of go off one by one with, oh, I've actually had 15 grand from bank from mum and dad. And
yeah.
And then you suddenly realise you're not in the same boat. And that then this sudden chasm opens up. And going back to what you said about migrants, yes, certainly there's people who you're far more likely to end up in the clutches of a rogue landlord if you are kind of in that demographic, because there's a lot of regulatory sort of obligations that landlords might not want to engage with, or maybe prejudice, or, you know, it's a real struggle to get in that loop. I think if you're locked out of the mainstream, you know, if your mainstream landlords see you as too much of a risk, if you don't have a credit history, that is a big factor in people kind of being refused. Or if you don't have a guarantor, that's another thing. So there's getting into the private rented sector can actually be, it can feel very, I don't know, like you're being interrogated and you're being sort of, I certainly felt like, I mean, I think my first rental property that I had when I was many years ago, and my dad became my guarantor, and he said, you do realize that they basically told me that even if I die, they're gonna come after my estate for the rent if you don't pay up. It was so invasive, and they kind of want to know, you know, your inside leg measurement kind of thing. So it's not a pleasant experience for a lot of people.
And of course, then, you know, the most extreme end of that then is homelessness. And, you know, in terms of generation rent, they are the most ones who are suffering most. We see, you know, the numbers are just phenomenal in the UK now, the level of homelessness, youth homelessness. And of course, many of those can't access a home in the private rental sector, or are being evicted from the private rental sector.
Absolutely. Yeah. A very common situation I would see is somebody who's been living in the private rented sector for quite a long time, sort of under the radar. They've taken for granted, but as you do, you just get into a rhythm with your life and you don't necessarily think, oh, what if I'm going to be evicted tomorrow? Yeah. But then they get a Section 21 eviction notice. And all of a sudden, I think if the landlord's not been sort of incrementally raising the rent, they might have just let them carry on paying what they paid 10 years ago when they first started renting. All of a sudden the landlord might look around at the local market and say, oh, I could get a lot more for my money, kick these tenants out. And because those tenants are used to paying an amount that is out of sync with the rest of the market, they're suddenly priced out of their whole city. I actually spoke to quite a few tenants who've been in the situation where one had to go from Bristol to Wales because she just could not afford anywhere in the vicinity, completely cut off from all of her friends, support networks, just general her life, really. And that was because she was on benefits, because she wouldn't be accepted by mainstream landlords. It kind of goes back to this thing I was saying about a lot of landlords just either because they don't want to take the risk or the perceived risk, or they're bound by what their mortgage company says or what their insurance company says. They sort of just say no, point blank, if you're on benefits, even if you're on benefits because you're disabled, whatever reason. And what it means is that these people end up, the only people that will take them are the rogue landlords. And in exchange for letting them have a home, the rogue landlords actually want to act with impunity. They want to be able to break the rules, do what they want, come in, let themselves in with their own key. So the poorer, the worse off you are, and the more precarious your lifestyle, the less amount of power that you have to really challenge the injustices in the private rented sector.
Yeah, no, and it's similar here. We have a, what's called a housing assistance payment here that people can access. But the problem is a lot of it's reliant on the private landlord's decision to whether to accept that or not. And you see a lot of the more vulnerable people, be they from migrant background or, you know, vulnerable in Ireland, that they are, you know, landlord won't accept them. And, you know, there's huge discrimination. In terms of the kind of the policies or what are the structural reasons, you know, for how did we get here?
Oh, well, I wrote a whole book about that question. but I kind of, one of the big seismic events that I kind of identified was how when buy-to-let investing, and I don't actually know how much this was also the case in Ireland, but certainly in the UK, buy-to-let investing became something that anyone with a bit of housing equity could join in with. So as soon as the buy-to-let mortgage was introduced, it became this kind of very easy extra little earner on the side for the average Joe. You didn't have to be a wealthy kind of millionaire. And I think a lot of small-time investors were really put off by, they wouldn't consider themselves investors at all. They would, you know, shun the stock market and more traditional kind of investments. But buy to let was just seen as this. There was a huge boom in the early 2000s. And that kind of was at the same time, that's, you know, simultaneously, there was a big boom in people just becoming obsessed with property and becoming, you know, you saw on TV, you had all these property flipping shows. And it always used to amuse me because what would happen is the expert would come in and say, right, well, to make this property, to do this property up, what you need to do is X, Y, and Z. This is based on my years and years of experience in the property investment sector. And this sort of amateur property flipper duo would be like, yeah. And then they'd not do any of that. And they'd probably just paint the walls orange and just do something their own taste entirely. And just do everything, just get everything wrong, basically.
Yeah.
I would always say, well, they ended up, you know, not adding any value to the property because similar homes on the same street that had nothing done to them are now valued the same. But because the general prices in the property market are rising, they've still made a profit. And I think there was a lot of people that were playing at this game, feeling like they were really, you know, making these clever deals. But they were just riding a wave of booming property prices. And definitely, I think buy-to-let fed into that, because even though every flipped property didn't become a buy-to-let property, the very fact that it was a backup plan for a lot of people, you know, they think, right, if we flip this and we can't sell it on at enough of a profit, we'll just rent it out for a couple of years. And then, the you know, when the price has risen enough, we'll cash in on the capital gains. So I think that massively crowded out the first-time buyer market. All of a sudden, first-time buyers were having to compete in this very, very hot, heating up market. And so, but funnily enough, the generation rent problem perhaps started in the early 2000s. But when it really, really began to bite was after the financial crisis. Because after the financial crisis, the mortgage market review came in. Many of its recommendations were implemented before it became mandatory, actually, just because banks were so cautious after the financial crash, and it massively tightened up affordability requirements, deposits. Prior to 2008, you had this huge explosion of mortgage credit to the point where, you know, the most infamous one was the Northern Rock Together mortgage, which was 125% of the property value is what they would lend you. So a quarter of the property value they would just give you as cash to spend. And it's no wonder there's people still nowadays who are in negative equity from that. They're a minority, but, you know, it just I think is testament to one of the first people I interviewed in the book, who was a landlord, and he was recalling what it was like at the time. He described it as a feeding frenzy. And I think as soon as it all, the music stopped and everything tightened up post 2008, because of the interventions that the Bank of England took to, you know, quantitative easing, where they expanded the credit supply and massively sort of propped up the system with, you know, just injecting cash basically into the financial system. And yes, it did help banks carry on lending at very, very high house prices, you know, against very, very high house prices. But the casualty was generation rent, because they weren't really allowed to crash, if that makes sense. Yeah. And I can explain that very well, but I went from a lot of topics there. But that's my canned version of what's happened in the last sort of 20-odd years.
Yeah, and in terms of that, because it is a very similar picture over here. And, you know, this maintained, now we had a very, you know, much greater collapse of house prices, but still they were maintained higher than what they should have fallen if the banks, you know, if the government hadn't intervened. And there's been this process since kind of 2010 of, you know, the kind of reinflation of property values and selling of assets and of course the emergence in Ireland. And, you know, I know you talk about this as well, of the real estate investment trusts and the financial, you know, the global financial investors who are now, you know, buying up and building this whole build to rent sector, which is in a way embedding, you know, generation rent on a permanent basis. Is that your kind of sense as well of what's happening in the UK?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of talk about reforming the private rented sector to make it more institutionalized so that we'll do away with what I was just talking about the amateur landlord, I think they call them accidental landlords. I don't know.
Yeah, accidental landlords or mom and pop landlords or those sort of phrases, yeah.
Yeah, and a lot of people are sort of saying, you know, let's embrace it, and we've obviously overprivileged home ownership, and why not have most of the population rent. They do it in Germany, and you know, it's sort of seen as a more progressive thing to think. But I'm just highly, highly skeptical of this, because the key thing that, yes, poor quality housing, insecure housing are major issues, and I'm, you know, a massive advocate for resolving those issues. But we aren't going to solve the generation rent problem until the affordability is addressed. And the major problem with affordability is there's two kinds. There's what you can afford now, just on a month-to-month basis, and there's what you are going to be able to afford for the rest of your life. And our whole model of work and then retire is based on at the end of your working life coinciding with paying off a mortgage. And housing costs are an enormous part, probably the biggest part of most people's outgoings. There was a story in The Guardian, I think, about a couple of years ago of a woman who was she was pretty much living off the state pension plus tiny, tiny extra amount. I think her total net income was about, or maybe even before tax, it was about 18 grand a year. Really not very much, and yet she lived in the centre of London in this kind of a mansion pretty much. And she was saying, you know, I can live on this, I can afford the lifestyle I want, I can go to the theatre, I can see my friends, I can afford to eat. And it's just that is the impact of housing costs. If you don't have your housing costs, you don't really need very much to live on. But if we're going to have a generation that are facing the prospect of renting in retirement, 25, 30 years, you know, with longevity is increasing, medical science is improving, people are living longer and longer. So either we're just never going to be able to give up work and we'll have to just do away with the concept of retirement entirely. Well, we're going to have to do something like triple the state pension, or, you know, for me, private renting throughout a lifetime is not the answer, because it just puts people in just makes people sink so much of the money that they go out to earn into housing when it doesn't need to be that expensive. You know, the thing as well that I always like to point out is it's housing can be cheaper because the landlords are paying a lot less for the housing. The landlords are paying a relatively low amount compared to tenants, because otherwise there'd be no profit. So someone's able to acquire it at an affordable price. And it's not necessarily affordability just in terms of the monthly cost. It's how you can access ownership and access the finance to actually get out of that rent trap.
And in terms of then, what do you see are the solutions? What should government do?
Well, this is, I think the problem with any solution is that housing has become a very zero-sum game. It's one of those things where in order for one party to benefit, another party has to lose out a little bit.
Mm.
And I think a reason why our housing policy has been so chaotic and so oriented towards keeping house prices inflated is because it's sort of a well-known thing that people, homeowners, tend to vote. They tend to be more likely to vote, and they'll vote for the parties they think are going to act in their interests. And in return, politicians then pander to them. They then institute policies that they think are win-win. So a good example of this is Help to Buy. That sounds like, you know, we're really giving the younger generation a leg up here. We're doing something positive to address this very important social problem. But the thing about Help to Buy is because it doesn't require prices to fall, it requires basically giving people a leg up to take on even more debt.
Mm.
It kills two birds with one stone. It gets people more technically into home ownership. But the main thing it achieves is it props up existing prices. And I think there's just this kicking the can down the road effect of, not just doing anything to avoid prices falling. So for me, in terms of what the solutions are, we have to be mindful of what's politically possible. So there's a solution, for example, where we take away the incentives a little bit for speculating in real estate and property, and we can do that via the tax system. So one possible solution that I have talked about in the book is something called a land value tax,
mm-hmm.
where people's properties and their, the improvements they make to those properties are not taxed, and that, you know, the building, if they add an extension or a conservatory, that doesn't give them an extra tax bill. But the actual appreciation of the property based on land values rising, that's that kind of more abstract, whenever the economy starts booming and prices just start going up because it starts being reflected in the price of property. If you were to tax that type of kind of value, then you would just bring down the incentives. You would stop that rampant speculation, because the more expensive a house gets or a property gets, the higher the tax bill will be. So there won't be as much of a, you know, I'm just going to buy and hold this and sit on it, do nothing with it, be completely unproductive, and wait for it to go up in value, and then cash in on the capital gains. And it's that kind of just sitting on assets and then, you know, what, expecting to go up in value and then expecting to pocket the gain. That is the price that renters then pay for in their higher rents. Mm. You know, so a land value tax, I could probably do a whole podcast on the rationale behind land value tax. And it's a very complex idea to explain, because I think people just generally don't like solutions that have the word tax in them. They like solutions that have free money, or just sort of anything that's about kind of just giving people. And I'm very in favor of solutions that involve, you know, like universal basic income, or I'm very, very big on public housing, publicly funded sort of council local authority housing. I think maybe a more elegant solution would be to do it to take away the perverse incentives in the tax via the tax system. The more politically possible solution might be to just reduce the dominance of the private rented sector through publicly funded housing, to just take people out of this market stranglehold and let people just build a little bit of financial resilience and access housing at cost and not for profit.
And in many ways, that has become what is considered a radical idea, even though it was very mainstream throughout most of the 20th century, until the neoliberal, revolution that essentially attacked everything that the public sector did. that, you know, the idea that, you know, the public, local authorities, local councils should build housing on scale is something that, you know, we're having a lot of debate about here in Ireland, and making, and I and others are making the case for it. But there still seems to be a huge resistance. And one of the ideas that we're promoting is the idea of like affordable cost rental housing, that so it's not just social housing for those on low incomes, but rental housing that's secure, affordable for any income, like they do in Austria and Denmark, that, you know, that, and there is growing support for this idea. Do you see, like, where is the debate at in for you guys in terms of that, like, you know, progressing public housing in new forms or expanding it?
I think it's the way that things have to go. I don't really see, if you conceptualize social housing as something that is purely a place where you can hide away the most sort of vulnerable in society or social problems, you know, people that have got a bad track record, antisocial behaviour, whatever. If you see it as a place in which to just carefully sweep aside marginalised groups of people, then that is a recipe for, it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you say, oh, social housing creates all these issues, but then you shrink the social housing stock to the point where you can only get a social home if you meet all of these criteria, of course you're going to get this ghettoization kind of effect where, you know, people, there's just a higher prevalence of crime or of social problems in these particular estates, because you're basically saying, well, the entry criteria is having, is, you know, and I think there's better social outcomes for people in general where we have mixed societies where we live side by side in communities. And so I think, for public housing to work at all, it has to be for pretty much everybody. I'm not saying, you know, anyone who's mega wealthy can just take up a social home or a public house, publicly funded house. But I think that we need to broaden the criteria of what we consider, you know, somebody to be eligible for cost rent public housing.
And do you see that, like, you know, you said, you know, what's politically possible or what's not, but, you know, do you think that, you know, surely Generation Rent, and, you know, we saw it, I think, and looking at from afar, you know, a certain amount of the growth and support for example, Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour Party in the last election was, you know, driven by the housing, you know, Generation Rent. You know, we absolutely saw it here in Ireland in the last general election, that the growth of parties like Sinn Féin was directly related to their position on calling for a rent freeze and public housing and decent, you know, affordable housing, that Generation Rent, you know, surely can become a political force that influences policy. But of course, the question is, what is it organized? Is it articulating a clear, you know, demand in policy, or is it, you know, divided and split, and also still caught to a certain extent with some people caught in the myth of home ownership and the illusion of home ownership?
Yeah. So what I found amongst Generation Rent, the biggest divide amongst kind of thing that's preventing that solidarity that you talk about is the Bank of Mum and Dad. And it's how they are. Oh, sorry, I feel like I've just lost my, I think I've, can I just start again?
Yeah, of course, yeah. We're clearly going to cut out this bit anyway, so.
Will
I ask you the question again?
Yeah, if you ask the question again, and then I'll get into my flow, because I was just trying to respond to something that I couldn't remember what I was responding to.
And I need to remember the question as well.
Solidarity and...
Yes, that's what I was saying, yeah. And, you know, the big question is, you know, how can Generation Rent become a political force to change policy, or does it have a, you know, a common even demand or ideas for what it wants? Or, you know, some people are looking to home ownership still, and many people who will never be able to become homeowners still think that they will be, and you know, want to support government policies that will support that, you know, rather than other policies that might actually benefit them.
Yeah, I mean, I did find that there is a lot of grassroots organising going on. So the biggest tenants union that has emerged in the last few years is one called ACORN. I actually joined and became a member as part of the research for my book. And what they do is almost because the law has become so unfit for purpose, and accessing justice just from the cost and the time that it takes has become just not really an avenue for fighting back for many tenants. So to kind of combat this, tenants unions have emerged whereby you can have the support of your peers. And if, say, for example, if there's an illegal eviction that's going to take place, you can call the union and people will show up. They will protest. They will picket your landlord. You know, all these strategies that are perhaps associated with protesting against a big corporation or some, you know, really powerful entity. You know, there are brilliant examples of, you know, tenants showing up at the sleepy suburban home of this landlord, and he's there thinking he can, you know, be awful to his tenants and really rinse them in the middle of a pandemic, raise the rent and threaten to evict them if they don't say yes. Then what he hasn't bargained for is that this this group of, you know, 50 odd angry tenants turning up in his neighborhood, embarrassing him and saying, you know, stop being evil, basically. So they're using the power of bad PR to really pressure private landlords into just playing fair and to try and rebalance that power dynamic. But a big undermining factor, actually, I think, of the solidarity of Generation Rent is the Bank of Mum and Dad, because we now have the emergence of intergenerational mortgages, where you don't necessarily have to give your children you know, a five-figure sum that you've had to save up, or you don't necessarily have to remortgage. You can just use the parental home as part of a security for the child's house. And you know, there's other ones where the parent doesn't have to give the child a deposit. They can just sort of say, right, here's 15 grand of my savings. I'm going to lock this away in a savings account and earn a little bit of interest on it. And in exchange for that, the bank says they can give you the mortgage without having to put your own deposit down. Mm. So it's making people who have access to housing wealth in their families, it's making it easier for them to get out of the private rented sector without having to really work any harder or be any more successful than their peers who don't have access to that. So it totally makes a mockery of the meritocracy of, you know, we're seeing a big divide where a lot of the people who are on the property ladder, I keep using that phrase as if it's a thing, obviously, yeah. The property, people who do own homes and they're under 35, more often than not, it's you, they'll have had some form of help. And yeah, it gives them a stake in the status quo, doesn't it? It creates a bit of a rift, it's harder to really fight for, I want house prices to fall, if you've just bought a house at current extortionate prices and house prices fall. Actually, it's first time buyers who are the most exposed because they don't have all the years of housing equity to cover them. So it does create divisions.
And it would seem to me that inequality is only going to grow, and that you're going to see, like, you know, the lower middle class, you know, lower paid workers, the lower paid or those reliant, you know, who are, you know, dependent on welfare supports and, you know, be they have, you know, disabilities, or that, you know, the more vulnerable, that there's, you know, that gap in inequality that, you know, that is actually going to grow further and further as people are left longer and longer in private rental. And then those higher, you know, higher middle class, higher income groups can buy out of it.
Yeah, I don't. And I really also don't think it's sustainable, because if you have a whole generation of people who were only really able to get into their own homes because their parents were able to give them this enormous capital leg up, they are not going to be as financially sound when they reach the same age. They're not going to have the same amount of housing equity. They might have you know, long-term care costs for their own parents to deal with. They won't be able to do the same thing. So as much as a moral dimension, you know, I wrote about this recently of, you know, the Bank of Mum and Dad it's causing divisions between young renters, but also often the Bank of Mum and Dad isn't necessarily that solvent. People are raiding their pensions. People are remortgaging. They're not particularly thinking about, am I going to have enough to live on in retirement? And so just if you look at it as a financial systemic risk, I think if the Bank of England was to really look into this, there would be actually a case for, on a financial policy level, to curtail financial help from parents as a sort of a macroprudential regulation, because it's not sustainable. It creates an artificial air bubble in the property market that eventually will have to collapse.
And just to finish up, our whole idea of, you know, and I see it in here, and I know it's something, you know, you've looked at as well, the idea of, you know, why isn't affordable housing being built for people? Why is the market not providing affordable housing?
Well, basically, it's because we can't get land for an affordable price. Currently, the planning system is a big factor. We have this very broken planning system whereby when it was first implemented, so I know you have a sort of a similar system, but I don't know exactly how similar it is. But in 1947, there was the Town and Country Planning Act, where in order to build anything, in order to develop any land, you had to get permission, discretionary permission from the local authority. And instantly, the policymakers could see this was going to create a two-tier land market. Land with planning permission would be massively more valuable than land that's just agriculture designated for agricultural use. And to get around that problem, they introduced a betterment tax, and which effectively meant that you couldn't just profit from that value uplift of a grant of planning permission. You had to pay that to the, I think it was a central land board that they had. So you could only profit off building things, off being productive, so they were trying to get the incentives right. But then what happened was lobbyists, landowners basically successfully managed to argue that this contravened their human rights, particularly because there was also a lot of compulsory purchase going on in order to acquire land for, by the development corporations to create these new towns and to build all, there was a massive social housing building boom, and we needed land for that. So compulsory purchase is one of the mechanisms by which that would happen. And people were saying, you're robbing me of my rightful due, because you're buying the land at agricultural value, but if it had planning permission to do what you're going to do to it, it would be worth millions. And so there was a series of reforms. The betterment tax was scrapped. There was also one called the Land Compensation Act, which kind of effectively forced, if there was going to be an acquisition of land and a compulsory purchase, it had to be not only the compensation had to say, this is, given the value uplift, but it would price in what was called hope value. Mm-hmm. Which is like, what could this land have become had it not been subject to compulsory purchase? And it was just basically building in rewards for speculators. So what started off as quite a well-intentioned planning system, it became corrupted to the point where now you can acquire land for very cheaply, but as soon as you get planning permission, the amount that you can make is millions for doing nothing, just for owning and sitting on a piece of land. So there is a lot of talk now about planning reforms to effectively try and wipe out that ridiculous perverse incentive system. But I think the reason that it's so controversial is because there's not a lot of talk really about taking on the big volume house builders and the big property developers who do have that power to monopolise the market. They own vast amounts of land, or they control lots of land through these things called option agreements, where they don't actually have to buy it. They can just kind of sign a contract that gives them the option to buy it if they get this planning permission. And because they control so much land, they can control the housing market in a local area. So if they build slowly, and if they they drip feed homes onto the market, then the homes that they do sell maintain their scarcity value, and they can continue to sell at these very, very high prices. And it just keeps the price of land inflated, and small developers who actually are better at delivering affordable housing have just not really been able to get a look in, because as soon as they bought the land, they've paid so much for it that they can't afford not to buy, to build that sort of luxury four-bed executive home, you know. It's not viable. I mean, there's also a lot of fudging of the numbers going on. We have these viability assessments where they can basically say, oh, yeah, yeah, we're making no profit. So, but they're just sort of using spreadsheets to pull the wool over the planning authority's eyes. So there's many, many things going on, but the land is fundamentally the problem. But we do have a big debate at the moment in front of us about how we equitably share this land that we all inhabit, and how to make sure that, you know, no one group gets too big a piece of the pie at the expense of everybody else.
Great. I think that you're absolutely right. The whole land question is absolutely fundamental. And it raises, as you say, the whole question of the resources we have and how we use them as a society. And it raises the broader issue, you know, of values and the housing system and what type of housing system we have. And of course, you know, phrases like, you know, how little the housing, it's always called the housing market. It's never called a housing system. And, you know, the housing system should, you know, meet people's housing need, whereas a housing market, of course, is about making profit, as, you know, treating housing as a commodity. And I think, you know, that fundamentally needs to change. And, you know, it does come back to me to, you know, to see that I think that there's a lot of Generation Rent are seeing that, you know, their future, and maybe, you know, that their future is in many ways, you know, it's terrifying in some respects, and that they will need to, and they've little prospect of buying their home, that they're going to.
I'm here as well. I'm not just an abstract observer. I'm 29. I'm renting, and I don't really see, I'm trying to save, but yeah. So I speak from experience as well as from research.
Yeah, no. And you know, and how does that, like, you know, make you feel about, you know, your future?
Well, it just makes me feel as if I don't necessarily have the option to, for example, the best job opportunities are in the capital. You can go and live in London and you can have much higher earning potential. But if you actually crunch the numbers, the amount that you have left over after rent means that you end up worse off. So you don't really get the benefit from the higher salary. And it just, you feel like, I mean, at the moment I'm in a place that, although it's not necessarily affordable in absolute terms, in that it's hard for me to save while I'm paying this amount in rent, it is relatively affordable. There aren't many cheaper flats in Sheffield of you know, that are not really, really grim. And even the really grim ones are perhaps like 50 quid a month cheaper than what I'm paying now. So because I'm in this flat, I almost feel like, oh God, I don't want to lose this place. It's got its faults, it's got its shortcomings, but, you know, it makes you more cautious. It makes you not do the things that youth is not, it's normally associated with youth, you know, like just traveling for a year or doing kind of taking off and trying a new career trajectory, and not, maybe it doesn't, you know, if it doesn't work out, then that's fine. But no, you feel like you really have to hang on to what little scraps that you can get. I'm by no means, I don't want to paint myself as a sob story. I think I'm very average in my experience. But, you know, knowing that I've had bad experiences and I'm not even anywhere near the worst, you know, I've really dreadful kind of dreadful things happening to people, and it's all perfectly legal, you know, and you just feel like nothing's going to change, you know. It's a bit... I don't really want to end on this because it's a little bit bleak.
No, but it's important in terms of that's the experience, and it's important that that's, you know, that's the reality and that's the lived reality. And I suppose maybe just, you know, that's what obviously did it. Is that what motivated you to write the book? Because I know as well that you were an aspiring playwright, you know, and it's kind of, you know, what brought you to write the book?
Well, I was a classic sellout. I sort of had these, I wanted to be in the arts, I wanted to write plays, and I did have some initial success. I set up the Sheffield branch of Script Yorkshire, this charity in the county that's supporting all script writers. And I also got onto a couple of writers development schemes funded by the Arts Council. I really felt like I was going somewhere with it. I kind of was meeting all these producers and I was getting little bits of work performed, and I just saw myself as a writer. You know, I just thought this is where I'm going to go. And then 2 years later, I was still, it's not obviously, I expect to have made it in 2 years, but I couldn't see any light at the tunnel. I was still working in a cafe part time and still sort of really not making very much money at all. And I got the odd bits and bobs of artsy related work, but it was really scraps, you know. And I could see people as well who were 10 years on from me. They were successful in many ways, in that they'd had plays put on, they'd been commissioned by the BBC, and they'd really made a bit of a name for themselves. And yet they were still there working in those survival jobs in the cafe. And it just made me think, I'm going to have to give up on my dreams here, because I just want a life. I want to be able to look forward to the future. I don't want to feel like I have to sacrifice everything on the altar of wanting to do this. So I just got a kind of a sensible 9-to-5 salary job in financial services. And the actual book opportunity came along when a couple of years later, and it was a competition offer. But I think it was kind of serendipitous, really, because my training, I've taken professional exams in finance. I've now kind of done quite a few roles in the sector. And I really think my insight into the financial world helped me to get that book deal and to win that competition. Learning about how the mortgage market works and how the different institutions that regulate the financial sector, and how buy-to-let feeds into it, how the investment sector feeds into it. And pensions were a big dimension. People issuing pensions because they didn't trust them, and buy-to-let become almost the stand-in for a retirement plan. So all of that, yes, I gave up on my dreams, but in a weird way, it sort of came back around.
They came back again, and you wrote this fantastic book, and you've got, you know, very positive reaction here in Ireland, but what sort of reaction have you had over there?
Really, really good. I was expecting it to be more controversial almost than,
yeah,
just because I know how divisive the debate can be. But what one thing that's probably surprised me the most is a lot of people from my parents' generation and, you know, what we would call the baby boomer generation kind of messaging me and saying, oh, I'm so glad somebody has tackled this problem. I'm so glad someone is writing a book about this, because I am so worried about my children and I'm so worried about my grandchildren. And this idea that it only affects generation rent, you know, that it's a unique problem that, you know, well, we're struggling, but at least the older folks are like, I'm all right, Jack. But yeah, that's more of a media caricature, really. Everybody's worried about this. I've got colleagues who say, yeah, we've made the decision to have one child because, and the child is two, we've made the decision to have one child because we think we can only help one child onto the property ladder. You know, socially, this is having such big impacts in every area, and it will benefit all of us if we can take real action to solve it.
Yeah. Chloe Timperley, thanks so much for joining me on Reboot Republic today. And I would absolutely recommend everyone to read your book, Generation Rent. It's an absolutely fantastic read, and best of luck into the future with it. And maybe just to really finish, I can't but talk to you currently without mentioning COVID. And, you know, you're in the middle of the outbreak of the, you know, this new strain in the UK. But broadly, you know, how do you see the housing crisis being reshaped by COVID, or do you see it?
Well, I think it swings and roundabouts, because I think there in many ways it's brought a lot of issues to the fore. We've got a huge issue with, and I'm sure you're probably having the same problems with, rent debt, people who, yes, we had these eviction bans, which were absolutely necessary to ensure we didn't have this huge spike in homelessness in the middle of a pandemic. But what the eviction bans ended up doing was, because it didn't lead, because normally the way that rents come down is through vacancies in the rental sector. So if you don't have any vacancies, there's no real signals to landlords to say, actually, this isn't the market rent anymore. People are not earning enough to pay this amount in rent. So rents have become very, very stuck. It's changing now, obviously, as you know, the realities of the economic realities of the pandemic start to set in. But we're still really in limbo because furlough is masking a lot of the true issues. You know, there's the eviction ban has kind of been kicked down the road because there's been no solutions to the rent debt crisis. So I really think it's going to force a lot of issues to be dealt with. And maybe, hopefully, we will see the end of the no-fault eviction. There's not been a peep from ministers about it, but we can still live in hope. So I think, yeah, the people who are on the more precarious end, people who are really, they don't have that family wealth to fall back on, are massively, massively struggling. But then there could also be another side of it where actually jobs become less concentrated in large cities. And because of the boom in remote working, you know, house prices tend to go up in areas where people can have better earning potential and better access to, you know, opportunities. So if you can have the same opportunities anywhere in the country, it might have a bit of a smoothing effect on the overall housing market. So potentially there could be benefits there. But to me, I don't see that as a solution because the systemic issues are so ingrained and they're so oriented towards these power imbalances. But yeah, it will certainly, the hope is that it will force issues to be dealt with and stop the government kicking the can down the road as they have done for so, so long.
Mm. Yeah, no, I agree. And I think it's similar over here that, you know, there's it's exacerbating kind of those underlying housing inequalities, that those who are locked out of home ownership are even going to be even further locked out. That if you look at the low paid sector, you know, you look at migrants, those who are hardest hit by the recession related to COVID are those who are in the private rental sector, and they're going to be locked even further out. So hopefully, you know, pandemics are also can be times which usher in, you know, major changes in policy. And I think that out of this one, we really need to see, you know, public housing and, you know, public housing for mixed income, you know, cost rental housing, you know, proper security of tenure being rolled out afterwards to recognize the fundamental importance of home in people's lives and in the economy as well.
Yeah. And even landlords are actually calling for it. A lot of the private landlords that I've spoken to have said, look, we can't take on this risk, this responsibility. We're not social workers. That's not why we are in this. So I think if you've even got private landlords saying, please build social housing, I think there would be a lot of support for it. People that don't support it are obviously the ones who are seeking to turn it into a big investment sector and have us all renting forever. But really, I think there would be the political support base for it. So, but I think coming back to what I wrote in the preface, it's not just about policy. It's not just about technical solutions. It is a moral problem as much as an economic problem. And we have to stop seeing our homes as this means of accumulating wealth. It's almost like, I mean, I find the whole idea of the home ownership dream really so profoundly underwhelming. Why are we dreaming about home ownership? Why is it a dream? Like, dream about really important stuff. Not, it's just having a roof over your head. At the end of the day, it's just somewhere safe to live and to go about your daily life and to kind of have a base where you can then, you know, go out to work and hang out with friends and all that kind of stuff. It's not this big life goal. So my hope is that if we can all kind of shift our mindset towards just having somewhere to live and not having to make money out of it, not having to have these capital gains year on year, I think all of us can then come to this agreement that we're willing to sacrifice that if it means everybody can have access to a decent home.
I absolutely agree. And that's the conversation we need to have, you know, at a national level, that it's time for homes and our housing systems to be deliver actual, that's what they are, homes for people and not, you know, financial assets and, you know, wealth accumulating commodities. And that's the big shift that needs to happen. Chloe, listen, thanks so much. Again, encourage people to, another plug, get Generation Rent. Absolutely encourage it. And when you're finished getting Generation Rent, if you're still up for reading some housing, you can read my book, Housing Shock, The Irish Housing Crisis and How to Solve It. But listen, Chloe, thanks so much for joining me today on Reboot Republic.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
Great. And as always, we put the shout out to listeners. Please, we know you listen, you're out there and you support what we're doing. This podcast costs to produce. It's an independent media. So if you can, whatever you can, fiver, tenner, 20 euro, whatever you can a month, go over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack, become a patron of Reboot Republic and support us to keep going. Thank you very much and talk to you soon.